I'm probably missing the point there, but.
Further comments, Representative Clark.
Mr. Sherman, if you look at Section 3, subsection 3, that's on page 4, lines 9 and 10. Nothing in subsection 1 or 2 of this section shall relieve a person from liability arising out of its ownership, operation, custody, or control of a facility in a capacity other than as a lender. I think I know what that's supposed to say, but I guess I'm a little bit concerned about that as it relates to the definition of lender. But the definition of lender is not crafted around the activity, but it is crafted around the person's status as a bank, SNL, credit union, finance company, whatever. Is the phrase in a capacity other than as a lender, does that create the fairly definite line that I think the bill is intended to create?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I understand the question, and I think it's one of the concerns that Mr. Hansen expressed about the bill as well. It's our intention that it speak to the activity of lending and that it say, we've got two standards, if you will, here. What you may do as a lender deserves one level of protection that we're creating by this bill. What you may do in some other capacity is not to be protected. Okay, I think there is a question to be raised there, and as you look at the definition of lender, it really is one that for some folks it's a status kind of a definition, and for other folks it's an activity. If you look at that definition on page 2 at line 27, you start out seeing that we're talking about persons conducting business as a institution, and then it names a whole bunch of other things, state agencies and so forth. If you get down a little further and you get to the broadest part of this definition, you go to line 16 on page 3.
Right, then it starts talking about activities.
Yeah, and there we're talking about activities. And so at least for that part of it, I think we've achieved what our intent is. As to the I want it clearly understood, and maybe it's appropriate to make it very clearly a part of the legislative record of this hearing, that what our intention is here is to focus on the activity and to say in lines 9 and 10 at sub 3 on page 4 that if you happen to be a financial institution or something else, but you create or for that matter simply own a piece of property that has hazardous waste on it in another capacity than as a lender, then you're not protected.
Right. And Mr. Chair, follow up then. I suspect, Mr. Sherman, that we could come up with some language either in subsection 3 of section 3 or in the definition that could clarify that the definition of lender is intended to be an activity-related definition and not a status-related definition, at least for the purpose of this bill. I think there's probably some language, and Representative Mannix probably is far better at this than I am, crafting that actual language, but I don't think that defeats what you're trying to do, as I understand it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ryan, Representative Mannix.
I'm just wondering, following that, if on line 28, page 2, if the wordsmiths would work along the lines of where it says any person conducting business as, and then, you know, that goes on from there. Well, of course, that very business could mean the take back and operation of, which is legitimate activity of a lender, but we're saying we want to narrow that back to the pure, simple lending. So if line 28 was expanded to read any person conducting business, you know, conducting the business of lending, but not including activities of ownership, custody, operation, or control. Does that get us anywhere?
I believe it's headed in the right direction. I want to be extremely careful as we work this language, but I think the goal is clear, and I think we're very comfortable with that clarification.
Representative Mannix?
I think that if you changed just a couple of words, everything would fit back together. If you look at line 10 on page 4, if we said, out of its ownership, operation, custody, or control of a facility in any role other than as a lender, we are then defining this in terms of the role that someone plays. Capacity is a nice term of art for lawyers, but it may not always be understood. a lender may have different roles to play. And we've defined lender here as a particular kind of player. But I could say, for instance, just bear with me for a moment, but say we look at lender. We start out saying any person conducting business, pretty general, as, and we say an institution, We go through this list of different kinds of institutions and individuals. Now, we've identified then institutions and individuals as lenders. We haven't defined them in terms of the role that they're playing. And they do lots of things other than lend sometimes. If we said role, we would recognize, and again, actually, I think that the history might be okay even on a capacity. Capacity is the same thing, I think. But maybe even just saying in any capacity other than as a lender. The word any instead of a would suggest that someone may have a variety of capacities. I'm a citizen, I'm a lawyer, I'm a legislator. I'm acting in my legislative role today. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do.
Mr. Bronner?
But Representative Mannix, when you say that lender means, and then you've got A, and that's the list of lenders, and then you've got B that says here's what a lender does, and C also what a lender does, we want to make it clear, and whatever it takes to make it clear, we shall do so. But B and C, you understand what I'm...
I see the conjunctive all the way over here on line 18 of page 3, because sub B and sub C are added in there, and we have very clearly narrowed down the role. Okay, I see what you mean. I'm putting a big circle around that and. This stuff is just amazing.
Well, we probably don't want to get stuck into the target.
My attitude is we don't need to. Looking at that language, they've obviously done a very nice job of going back and tightening it and tightening it.
My only one last comment I'd like to have Representative Clark's input on this. If we add on page 1, under the definition of foreclosure, if we had in there the word by receivership into that definition that goes on to page 2, and then from your folks out front, if that would alleviate any concern about Section 3, about the fact that they may be in control, not be in what we define normally as a foreclosure. But this foreclosure definition is pretty, is that a problem? Is that something that... To my mind, that makes the whole thing fit together, and then we don't have a tangle with anywhere else.
We concur.
Okay, because I think that's intended by that, but just to make it clear in that way...
Where do you want that, Mr. Chairman?
I want it in any top of page 2, line 1, would be anywhere in there, by receivership, right after a non-judicial foreclosure proceedings, comma, by receivership, whatever.
Mr. Chair, the only problem I have with it, and it may be just my kind of barrel thinking. I don't know. There's something that doesn't fit in my mind about defining receivership as part, or including receivership as part of foreclosure, the definition of foreclosure.
Well, they've got it pretty expanded there.
I know they do.
And I just was trying to get it to dovetail with subparagraph B under Section 3, where it talks about acquired through foreclosure.
Yeah, I know. And it works in the bill.
We're not going to apply this to the general rule.
Yeah, your law professors and my law professors wouldn't like it.
Or we wouldn't be here today, probably.
I guess the question is whether or not the proponents can live with that phraseology in there, if you think that that's going to screw things up. If not, I don't mind adding the insurance policy.
Adding it as an insurance policy.
Yeah, I do, but we already got that all blown up.
I think that's fine, Mr. Chairman.
By receivership after non-judicial foreclosure proceedings?
Mr. Chair, could I point out, although I don't think it, again, does any damage to the intent, if you look at page 3, line 19, in the definitions of a lender, it includes... Also, in the definitions of lender, it includes any receiver or other custodian appointed to take possession.
But you understand what that does when you read that definition into subparagraph A under Section 3. It says, in which the receiver holds
takes
a security
possession.
Interest or which the receiver holds the controls or manages pursuant to the terms of an extension of credit. You could argue that a receiver can therefore be exempt without any further conduct and be a part of creating the mess. And if you, that's what I read the whole bill is why I came back to receiver. Maybe tell me different. I'm interested in hearing it. But receiver, if the receiver is a lender, and under subparagraph A it states, in which the receiver holds a security interest or the receiver holds or controls or manages, is exempt from liability, then you've given them an out under, if they've just appointed a receiver, then it can get away. And I just want to tighten that up. If you don't want the receiver's...
This is a receiver that's appointed to enforce a lender's rights. And I think that I think that narrows it down to alleviate your concern.
And well, in connection with an extension of credit.
Unless I'm missing the point.
Yeah.
Line 20.
Arguably holds the receiver in a position where the receiver could be in control of property, and you could be trying to give them time to work out an extension of credit while you receive the property, and they may be out trying to get financing from other folks, and arguably could give a bank a way out, which, you know, may be fine. Yeah.
If you Mr. can live by receivership and the chair likes it, why don't we just do it?
Oh. Well, we're not going to insist on that, but it would do a good thing.
Oh,
Mr. Chair, I do believe that it clarifies, and we have no problem with the insertion by receiver.
Can we get a motion on that, then?
Are we in work session yet?
We opened up a work session at first. We just had
Mr.
to buy
Chairman,
the testimony up.
I move to insert the phrase, by receivership, after non-judicial foreclosure proceedings on line 1 of page 2.
Thank you. Representative Maddox moves that we insert by receivership. On line 1, page 2 of the bill, after the phrase non-judicial foreclosure proceedings. Representative Clark.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Reminds me of sausage, but that, I'm not going to...
We already started down that road earlier.
In terms of proper grammatical style, I notice that we're saying acquired title to or possession of property through, and I guess we shouldn't use the word by there, but just put in receivership.
Okay, through receivership. Receivership.
So just receivership.
Just receivership. Representative Miller, do you have a comment? No comment. The amendment so adopted without objection. We have a motion on the bill. Move the bill as amended.
The bill as amended to the full committee with a due pass. Oops, there may be something for Clark.
Yeah,
I withdraw the motion.
Thank you. I would just like to revisit for a minute.
Bell in here.
Yes. Representative Mannix, you talked a little bit. I raised a concern with Mr. Sherman about the phrase the lender and whether it's a capacity question or a role question. You had a line of questioning. I didn't hear what the outcome of that was.
We came back around to, on page 2, it's we've got such a lengthy definition here that I dropped the ball on this. On page 2, lender means, line 27, we start with small letter A, sub A, and went through all of that. I didn't pick up on the fact that on page 3, line 16, we had a sub B about extension of credit. And on line 18, the conjunctive, any receiver, all three of those, A, B, and C, are all in the conjunctive. All three of those have to be met, and so you've really narrowly defined the role of the lender anyway.
Okay.
That's why.
All right. Then sort of Mr. Chair, in the spirit of it does no violence to the intent of the statute, I would move that on page 2, line 28, in the definition of lender, that we insert the words after any person, that we insert the words to the extent that the person is, so that it would read, lender means, sub A, any person, comma, to the extent that the person is conducting business as. And I don't believe that, at least what the testimony in response to my question was, I don't think that causes anybody any problems. It makes clear that the definition of lender for getting you out from under liability in the statute only applies to the extent that you are doing lending.
So move, Representative Clark, any objection? Hearing none, so Duffin.
Chair.
Representative Mannix.
Move the bills amended to the full committee with a due pass. We have five.
Representative Mannix moves the bill as amended to the full committee to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Votes yes. The bill, having received the appropriate majority, is forwarded to the committee, as amended, House Bill 3349, with a due pass recommendation. We have any volunteers on the carrying of that?
Chairman.
Representative Mannix. Appreciate that. We're going to close the work session, House Bill 3349.
Want to take a five-minute break to give our...
Now we're going to give a five-minute recess. We hope to... Well, 10-minute recess. We're going to reconvene at 3:15. Thank you. We're adjourned. We're in recess temporarily. Convene. The House Committee on Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration. We're going to open up briefly a public hearing on House Bill 3279 to allow Mr. Phillips to come up and testify, and then we're going to go right from there to the hearing on work session, I guess, on 2828.
And then back to 3279.
Then back to 3279 for those of you that want to understand. We might have staff just briefly. I think this bill's pretty self-explanatory, but you might take a two-sentence shot at it, will you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3279 makes the English rule the Oregon rule, awarding attorney fees to the prevailing party in all cases. You have in your material samples of various attorney fee statutes. I've also included a copy of the index from the Oregon revised statutes demonstrating how many pages of attorney fee statutes there are. In current law, you have a letter from Deanne Darling, a Clackamas County attorney, expressing her support for the proposal, and also a copy of Alaska Rule of Civil Procedure 82, which appears to be the closest thing that any state has to the proposal that's before the committee. If the members of the subcommittee are interested, I have collected a couple of law review articles on the topic discussing pros and cons of the English rule and its effect on various aspects of litigation. We do not yet have a impact statement from the Legislative Fiscal Office.
We expect to receive a brief summary of those law review articles from Representative Miller at the appropriate time, perhaps today.
Certainly.
Go ahead,
pro
Mr.
articles.
Phillips.
Chair, I appreciate your accommodating my schedule. I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and expressing my considered opposition to Bill 3279. As the staff has indicated, adoption of this bill would reverse the preferred practice under American law for at least 200 years, which is to not generally provide attorney's fees to the prevailing party. Certainly, we have a history in which there are individual fee-shifting statutes. The closest to general operation that we would see of this is 42 U.S.C. Section 1988, which provides attorney's fees to the prevailing party in civil rights cases. There are several other similar statutes, each of which has generally been adopted by a legislative body in order to encourage rather than discourage certain forms of litigation. The effect of the statutes of the individual kind has generally been to assure that plaintiffs who have been injured or wronged by certain acts receive the full amount of compensation for their injuries without having to deplete that by bearing their own costs of litigation. You ask then, why, as an OTLA member, am I here in opposition to the bill? I'm in opposition to the bill for three reasons. The first of those is that the bill encourages rather than discourages litigation. It does that in at least three ways. The first of those is that it will have generally the effect that 42 U.S.C. Section 1988 and the bills and other federal legislation, which I've indicated in my written materials has, and that is to encourage certain types of litigation. Secondly, by providing that attorney's fees are to be awarded only in the event of judgment at the time of trial or on appeal, there are certain numbers of litigants who, in order to assure that they will have full compensation, will be required to litigate their claim rather than settle it. Thirdly, in terms of encouraging litigation, the history of litigation or of attorney's fees shifting legislation throughout has been to adopt and attach to every piece of litigation a second body of litigation that is litigating the attorney's fees dispute. I indicate anecdotally that I tried a case in May of last year under the Federal Civil Rights Act, obtained a judgment for a city employee of the city of Eugene. We are now in the 10th month of litigation over attorney's fees to which he is entitled by statute. There is no end in sight in that litigation. And that has simply been the history throughout of Section 1988 attorney's fee litigation. It would be a burden on the courts of this state to attach that ancillary piece of litigation to every lawsuit tried in this state. Secondly, I oppose the bill because it repeals, apparently for the sake of uniformity, the well-reasoned judgment of this legislative body in numerous cases in which the body has adopted attorney's fees provisions for prevailing plaintiffs but not for prevailing defendants. Those, for example, are ORS 20.080, which was designed by the legislature to encourage resolution of relatively small claims, those under $4,000. The effect of this bill is to encourage rather than discourage litigation of those claims. Another example, the provisions under the state's Public Information Act, which was designed by this legislature to encourage citizens to force their government into public operations. The effect of this bill is to discourage the citizens in attempting to do that, apparently only for the sake of uniformity. But most importantly, I oppose the bill and OTLA opposes the bill because of the effect it will have on a body of potential litigants that we think are most in need of and ought most to be encouraged to use their government, including its judicial process. Those citizens of Oregon who will be most adversely affected by this bill are those hardworking Oregonians who have developed an equity in their home, developed small amounts of savings, who have a job with income that can be garnished for the next 20 years. Those people who have bona fide disputes, good faith disputes with others, will be discouraged from using the court in order to have resolution of their case for fear that they will be wrong in that dispute, or worse yet, will simply not be able to prove their case even if right. For those people, they will have at risk their present and their future in giving up their savings, their home equity, the savings for their children's college education, simply for the opportunity of having tried to avail themselves of the court. Professor Goodhart, writing some 60 years ago in the Yale Law Review, set forth the reason socially for the American rule, and he said it this way: the spirit of fair play inherent in frontier life required that parties be able to submit their controversies to the court without being deterred by the prospect of high costs, and that the losers suffer no more than defeat. It is OTLA's belief that the hardworking Oregonians who have acquired modest financial success continue to be deserving of that spirit of fair play, and it is for the reason that the courthouse door would be shut to those Oregonians that we oppose this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
What's in the hearing?
How do the English pull this off? Do you know? I mean, you may not know because I don't know. So I'm
They do it with a far different attitude about litigation and the role that litigation plays in dispute resolution. I mean, there simply is less there. Where, in fact, our efforts at shifting attorneys' fees have been designed to encourage litigation. I mean, it is a less litigious society.
Okay.
And I don't think, it's our view that adoption of this bill is not going to make this a less litigious society. It's going to make it a more litigious one because we're going to be litigating attorneys' fees as well as everything else.
Mr. Representative Miller.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, as the sponsor of this measure, I want to tell you I'm not against hardworking, caring Oregonians. And I appreciate your concern. But I guess I heard you in your beginning, you talked about how this would encourage litigation. Your closing, you said it would discourage litigation. And
no,
guess I'm confused as to which one of those tracks you want to be on.
No, I think, as a general matter, it will encourage litigation, and it will encourage litigation.
Even though you're convinced the English system discourages litigation.
I didn't say that the system discourages it. I said that it is a less litigious society with the attorney's fees provision having little or nothing to do with that. They have simply a different view about how some disputes are to be resolved than we do. And there's nothing I'd suggest that indicates this is going to reduce the amount of litigation. It simply is not a measure that gets at frivolous litigation, if that's a concern. We already have a provision that allows attachment of attorney's fees to both litigants and their attorneys if they brought frivolous litigation. This bill doesn't do anything about that. What it does do is assure that in some areas we're going to be litigating more things than we already are, and we're going to attach to every piece of litigation a rider about some other issue to be resolved by litigation. When I said that I thought it discouraged litigation, I think it affects a body of our politic and discourages those people from litigating. And the people that it discourages are ones who have some assets for which the taking of those assets would be devastating. The bill does not affect the poor, does not discourage them from litigating, because a judgment against them for attorney's fees doesn't make a lot of difference and can be discharged in bankruptcy without much adverse effect to them. It does not affect access to the court of the wealthy, because it is simply for them a cost of doing business, including the wealthy by virtue of people having pooled their assets in an insurance company and paying insurance premiums. The people it discourages, and the only people it discourages from litigating in this state by this bill, are those who have a modest amount of assets, or losing those by virtue of a judgment of having been wrong in a good faith dispute would be devastating.
Well, I've got to go testify on another bill, but just, I guess I'll, at the appropriate time, state my disagreement, but also suggest that I have a concept I've endorsed before and will probably advance, perhaps even in a bill we saw earlier today, an idea that suggests that those who are involved in frivolous lawsuits, attorneys should be disbarred. Would you support that idea?
I have no quarrel with the notion if somebody is intentionally engaged in frivolous litigation. The problem, and if you want to address that issue at this stage, is the identification of what litigation is frivolous and not frivolous. And if you can find a decent way of defining that, I don't have any quarrel that none of us ought to be engaged in that activity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious about your comments about the British system. Theirs is a less litigious society, and I think I subscribe to that notion, and it probably has more to do with their culture and their sort of inherent conservatism, and also with the fact that we've been very specific in this country about what our rights are, and we write them down here, and so people know about them, including a certain segment of society who might not otherwise and might be afraid of the courts. I think you would agree that we have too much litigation in this society. Now, maybe you wouldn't, and I guess I need to ask you that first off.
We have a lot, and we have it at about the same rate that we've had it for 200 years. We have a lot more people, and as a result, we have a lot more litigation.
We have more people in this country than we did, effectively so, than we did 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and litigation rates are higher.
Criminal litigation is a lot higher, but if you look at civil litigation and the civil litigation rates, the rate has remained about the same for years, save for some strange things. I mean, if you